insight behind this project from its very inception to this moment of its dedication. The mayor's ears were finally attuned to measuring crowd reaction, and he calculated that the applause for him, sparse as the audience had become, was slightly more than the governor got. That boded well for next year's election campaign, even though the mayor had more of his dependents out there than the governor had. "Today," the mayor said after thanking the MC for his glowing introduction, "we dedicate more than a structure of concrete and steel. We dedicate ourselves to the proposition that Miami Beach will remain a viable community despite the worst that nature can hurl against us." Behind him, behind the stage and its billowing canopy, rose a wall of gray concrete that stretched the length of what had once been a beautiful beach. Now the beach was completely gone, replaced by a seawall 20 feet high, gray and grim and resolute. It protected the line of hotels and condominium high-rise buildings that stood shoulder to shoulder along the former beachfront, towers of glass and steel and developers' dreams. Florida's seaside resorts and retirement communities had been devastated by the gradual rise in sea level and the increasing violence of storms powered by the rising greenhouse effect. Many cities and towns had lost their beaches, their seafront palaces, even their marinas and canals to the encroaching ocean. Causeways had been inundated or even washed away entirely. Whole towns had gone bankrupt. Mass migrations northward and inland had already begun. The Miami Beach Seawall Project was the answer to the problem, the gauntlet thrown down in the face of nature by a combination of desperate private developers, frantic Florida bankers, and frenzied local and state politicians. Using federal, state, and even private funding, they had built a seawall that would protect Florida's showcase resort city from the rising sea and the raging storms. In truth, the mayor had been a driving force behind the project. Scientists from Washington had said that no seawall could stand against the full might and fury of a mammoth hurricane. Yet other scientists, especially those from Florida universities, maintained that a wall could be built that was strong enough to do the job. Now it was completed, and the mayor stood basking in the glow, figuratively, of his mighty accomplishment. It had cost billions, as the media and the mayor's political enemies pointed out repeatedly, but it would save the hundreds of billions already sunk into the city's buildings, streets, and infrastructure. "Now Miami Beach is safe," the mayor proclaimed, straining his voice against the growing bluster of the wind. "Now we no longer have to fear rising ocean levels or damaging storms." Behind him, waves crashed against the seawall, thundering harder and harder against its concrete face. Driven by an ever fiercer wind, the ocean seemed to be smashing itself against this new challenge. The seawall held for the time being, but an especially powerful gust of wind ripped away the canopy that protected the VIPs up on their makeshift stage. Screams, shouts, and the horrible groaning of timbers. The plastic canopy, suddenly torn loose, flapped wildly and knocked the mayor and several other VIPs off the stage, 12 feet down onto solid concrete. Then the entire stage shifted and tilted and came crashing down. The mayor, his wife, four others on stage, and the three closest TV camera persons were killed. The governor escaped with only a few broken bones. In the tumult and confusion, no one noticed that the ocean waves were already lapping over the top of the seawall, sending dark gray fingers of water down its other side and onto the protected ground behind it. And this was not a hurricane, not even a tropical storm, merely a few gusts of wind. Dan Randolph knew nothing of the tragedy in Florida. He had finally been allowed to share a meager meal of frozen fish and rice from packages that bore the heron symbol of Yamagata Industries. The microwave oven in which Pops Tucker heated the food was not original equipment for a temporary shelter, Dan knew. It had been brought in from somewhere else. Big George talked expansively during the meal of his younger days growing up in the opal mines of Australia.
"After living in Cuba Pedy most of my life, I thought these underground cities on the moon would be downright luxurious. And they were."
Tucker stayed silent throughout dinner. But every time Dan glanced at him, the sour old man seemed to be watching him, eyeing him carefully, craftily, like a judge sizing up a convicted man before sentencing, or like a salesman trying to figure out how much he can charge for a used piece of merchandise. Dan said nothing to the wrinkled, gnomish little man. He wondered if the pistol in his thigh pocket made a big enough bulge to be recognized. He realized that it was only a matter of time before the GEC put a price on his head. That's what Tucker's trying to figure out. How much am I going to be worth to him? Dan and Big George talked for a couple of hours after dinner, with Tucker making rare contributions to their conversation. George bragged about the work he had done on the moon's surface, braving the dangers of radiation and the billion-to-one chance of a meteoroid hit. Despite himself, Dan began talking about his days on the early construction jobs in orbit and the first rugged mining operations on the moon. After a while, George went silent, and Dan found himself narrating story after story about those pioneering times. He did not even have to embellish the truth to keep the big Aussie spellbound.
"I'm going to sleep," Tucker said at last. He made it sound cranky, accusative. "If you guys are going to keep spinning yarns at each other, do it quietly, okay?"
George shook his shaggy mane as if awakening from a trance.
"Yeah, it's getting light. Time to sleep." "You can have the upper bunk over George," Tucker said to Dan, pointing. "And I'm a very light sleeper, so don't try anything funny."
Dan gave him a laugh. "What do you think I'm going to do? Run away and hide?" Tucker snorted disdainfully.
"That's how you got here, ain't it?"
Dan acknowledged his point with a shrug. They took turns in the toilet, then climbed into their respective bunks without removing their coveralls. Dan's body still ached from George's pounding, but he fell asleep almost immediately, exhausted physically and emotionally. If he dreamed, he did not remember it the next morning. Raffaello Gaetano sat on the flagstoned patio in the warm evening breeze and gazed up at the sliver of a moon dancing in and out of the clouds. Then he looked down into the streets and sighed. At least the stench of the city did not reach up this far to the hillside villa. Reggio di Calabria had been a beautiful city once, down at the toe of the Italian boot, across the strait from Sicily's Messina. Reggio's waterfront had once been described as the most beautiful kilometer in Italy by no less than the poet D'Annunzio. Now the city was bursting to overflowing with people driven off their parched farms by the drought. The streets were choked with garbage. Homeless people fought the rats every night. The waterfront was awash in filthy water half the time. In daylight you could see the high tide marks on the buildings, creeping higher all the time. Drought and flood. Gaetano wondered how they could both be happening at the same time. Perhaps this greenhouse business was real after all.
"Escaped, you say? How could the man escape? Where can he run to up there?"
Gaetano returned his attention to the fat, wheezing old man sitting across the patio table from him. Don Marcello Arcangelico had been at death's door ever since Raffaello had been a boy. But the old man refused to cross death's threshold. Beneath his pasty, sagging skin was a heart pacemaker, an artificial hip, a transplanted kidney, and plastic tubing in place of worn-out arteries. The man was a tribute to modern medical science and his own indomitable will to continue living at any cost. In the evening shadows, with only the lights from the house and a few flickering fireflies, it was difficult to read the expression on Don Marcello's fleshy face, but the tone of his voice was unmistakable. He was not pleased. Gaetano reflected swiftly that it did not matter to Don Marcello that he was a council member of the GEC, one of the most powerful men in what was in effect the government of the world. Governments did not impress Don Marcello. He saw them merely as impediments to business, as greedy bureaucrats with their hands out for bribes, or, worse, honest do-gooders who wanted to rid the world of businessmen such as himself.
"So?" the Don asked impatiently. "How could he escape? Where has he gone?"
With great care to keep a tone of respect in his voice, Gaetano replied, "I don't know how he escaped. He was in his own headquarters, however. There must have been many men there who are loyal to him.
He must have had considerable